Ja, hörni, tack ska jag väl börja med att säga till mina partners som gör Träning och Fika-podden möjlig helt enkelt. Att vara med och hjälpa till och stötta för att jag ska kunna spela in och intervjua och prata i Träning och Fika-podden är möjligt tack vare mina partners som just nu är Bageriprodukter, det är Adventure Academy och Acid Training. Tack så hemskt mycket för ert bidrag och ert stöd. Sen kan man ju då som privatperson också gå in och stötta produktionen genom att ge ett litet bidrag på till exempel Patreon. Det uppskattas väldigt mycket. Där kan du välja mellan att köpa en kaffe svart eller lägga lite mer pengar och köpa en kaffelatte och så fortsätta hela vägen upp till en riktigt härlig brunch. Så ja, tveka inte. Gå in och stötta lite. Det behövs och jag blir glad. Tack ska ni ha. Nu kör vi igång!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
By the end, there's like a hunger which is physical, where you have an empty stomach and there's a space that needs filled. But then there's a hunger that moves away from your stomach and goes like into your cells and bones. So your body is like, give me food. And I could see my six pack for the first time, literally forever. So I was like, I must have lost 15 kilograms here.
Oh, really?
And then I complained about being hungry so much that I actually didn't tell my teammates I put on weight, because they must have been like, you clearly weren't hungry then. So I couldn't believe that.
You actually were hungry and put on weight.
Yeah.
Så där hör ni, kära vänner, bekanta och människor jag absolut aldrig har träffat, men som lyssnar på en av de absolut bästa podcasterna som finns, nämligen Träning och Fika med mig, Fredrik Eriksson. Hör ni, idag ska vi köra en podcast på engelska, så jag ska alltså prata svengelska med en kille, en äventyrare som heter Mark Agnew, som vi ska prata om hans fantastiska äventyr genom Nordvästpassagen i kajak. Så ja, vad brukar jag säga? Buckle up, håll i er, nu kör vi igång och varmt välkomna till ännu en podcast.
Träning och fika, vi kör hårt. Träning och fika, blåsa på. Träning och fika, går ihop som kaffe och popcorn. Träning och fika, vi kör på. Träning och fika, blåsa på. Träning och fika, nu kör vi! Nu kör vi!
Ja, men så där, då var vi ju igång och jag är alltså i München på ISPO-mässan. Och det är en mässa som handlar om sport, äventyr och outdoor. Där finns också ett par stora scener och på en av de scenerna så delar jag varje år ut priset till Europas främsta äventyr och äventyrare. Och det ska jag göra i år också. I år så är det så att vi har då landat på att vi ska dela ut priset till en kille från Skottland som heter Mark Agnew. Och Mark sitter här bredvid mig. Han pratar ju väldigt dålig svenska. Så vi kommer switcha över till engelska. Så Nice to meet you, Mark.
Yeah, nice to meet you. I didn't understand a thing you were saying to introduce me, but I'm sure you're telling the audience how incredibly good looking I was and everything like that.
And strong.
And strong, obviously. I'm strong and, like a ball.
Which you are.
Yeah, I am. In fact, when I finished the Northwest Passage, I would have assumed that I would have been like lost 15 kilograms and be incredibly weak, but I put on 5 kilograms.
Oh, really?
I lost all of my fat. I looked like a Greek statue for about 5 days, and then I returned to my normal state, which is looking a bit like a melted candle.
But that is kind of funny, because when I was going on roller skis across Sweden from the north to the south, everybody's like, you know, I did a Vasaloppet. I did 90K on skis every day for 28 days. And I didn't lose a pound.
Yeah.
Because I was eating candy and stuff all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was so, so hungry. We all suffer, you know, everybody's different. So we all suffered from different things differently. My teammates, I was with three others. We were in two double kayaks. And I suffered the least from the cold. But I suffered the most from the hunger, you know. And by the end, there's like a hunger which is physical, where you have an empty stomach and there's a space that needs filled. But then there's a hunger that moves away from your stomach and goes like into your cells and bones. So your body is like, give me food. And I could see my six pack for the first time, literally forever. So I was like, I must have lost 15 kilograms here.
Oh, really?
And then I complained about being hungry so much that I actually didn't tell my teammates I put on weight, because they must have been like, you clearly weren't hungry then. So I couldn't believe that.
You actually were hungry and put on weight.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe I was hungry because I was building so much muscle. Yeah. You know, I must have lost, you know, to put on 5 kilograms and lose all of my fat, must have lost 5 kilograms of fat and put on 10 kilograms of muscle. So to build 10 kilograms of muscle takes a lot of calories. And generally I was hungry. But then, like, in the last 10 days or 2 weeks, that hunger became like, you know, I was just surviving between meals. And if I, like, you know, rushed something and just missed a couple of hundred calories, then I would suffer so much.
Oh, really?
You know, usually in the morning, I'd wake up, immediately down this 400-calorie mix called Huel. Then I'd have a meal, and then I'd try and down another one of them before we started kayaking. And if I, like, missed one of them, oh, well, I'm not that hungry. I already had a Huel and a thing. That's like 2,000 calories before I even started the middle of the day. And if I missed the second one, I'd kayak for 2 hours. And then, you know, we'd go from like 4 miles an hour, and it would happen like a click. I'd down to 2 miles an hour.
You hit the wall.
And like, it affected me emotionally. I'd had like absolutely no, snap at people, and I wasn't self-aware enough. I was so hungry that I couldn't like realize it was hunger. So Eileen would have to go, are you hungry? No, I'm not hungry. And they were like, maybe you should eat something. And I'd eat something, and equally immediately I'd go, wow, like I feel my, energy again. Know,
Mark, it sounds like my wife.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I knew when I'm hungry, I'm particularly bad company at the best of times. But like, it was just those last 2 weeks where I was just so depleted. But in the first half, we came across a cabin called Fort Ross, which is the last existing cabin from the Hudson Bay Company. And it was built in like 1680. So it's a historic place, and a lot of sailors stopped there. Yeah. It's sort of like a youth hostel. It was like a shelf where people left food, like pasta and stuff that didn't go on.
So you took all the food.
So I made enough pasta for like 5 people, and I covered it in sugar. And then I ate like a starving man. Or I mean, maybe I was a starving man. And that was like, there was like 2 things going on there. There was like my intellectual, like evolved brain that was saying, this is disgusting. You are very full. You don't need more food. And then there was like a primal brain that was like operating my hands as I like shoveled it into my mouth. And I ate and ate and ate till I felt sick. And I lay down like panting, and I had to take some nausea pills, which made me feel better. So I kept eating.
Oh,
and
really?
It was like out of my control. It was like a compulsion, how hungry I was. And then when we stopped up in Cambridge Bay at halfway, I did the same thing again. I ate and ate and ate until I like was actually
But did
panting.
The other do that too?
No. Yeah,
they were normal.
They were like super hungry, and they were like, yeah, we're all hungry. And then they were watching me, and they were like, that guy's really hungry. They were like, I think it actually like developed sympathy for them. They were like, I thought I was hungry, and then I watched you eat. Now I realize. Shit.
So, Mark, you're Scottish.
I'm Scottish, yeah.
Where in Scotland are you from?
I'm from Edinburgh.
But like you've been living a long time in Hong Kong.
Yeah, so after university, I immediately moved to Hong Kong.
Right? Why?
Not because I don't like Britain, but I wanted to live somewhere else apart from Britain while I was young and like responsibility free.
Is it like open exciting. For you to go there, like the British kingdoms?
You can go there as a tourist without a visa, but to work you need a visa, and to get a visa you need somebody to employ you. So I thought my ticket abroad, and it wasn't specifically Hong Kong I wanted to go to, my ticket abroad would be my rugby, because there's obviously like professional rugby, which I'm not good enough at, but all over the world there's like a level just below that where people maybe give you a little bit of money in a flat and then find you a job. And I sent emails out and put my name on websites, and then one got back to me from Hong Kong. They gave me like the equivalent of about 600 euros a month for the first 3 months, free accommodation for the first 6 months, with the promise that they'd introduce me to lots of people to get jobs. And I became an English teacher when I first got there, because that's an easy way to get a visa, because they can say, well, we have to employ somebody who's English speaking, so they can justify getting there. But then I became a journalist as a result, and I stayed there for 8 years.
But the rugby?
Yeah.
How is that going?
How's it still going? I stopped playing rugby in 2018 as I prepared to row the Atlantic, with the idea that after the Atlantic, I would get back to rugby, but I just never have. I've just began to realize what I enjoyed was more and more these like outdoor endurance things and less rugby.
How old are you now?
I'm 32.
32. And you have a wife?
I have a wife.
One?
An 18-month-old and another baby due any day.
Any day.
By the time this podcast is produced, maybe I will be a father of two.
We hope so.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be nice.
Unless I get the call in the middle of the podcast.
That's perfect. So when you played rugby, what position did you have?
Do you know rugby?
Not that much, but...
Yeah, I was. I like to think I was a number eight, but as I got slower and everybody else got better, I moved to second row.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're in the group.
Yeah, in the forward row. Pack. Yeah, yeah. The people, the ugly people with no skill.
So did you like being in Hong Kong?
It is an amazing, amazing place. Everything is like 400 miles an hour. And there's no like middle ground. You don't have a couple of pints on a Friday and then run 5K on a Saturday. You either have a 3-day drinking bender or you run an ultra marathon. There's like nothing, anything in between. And that's sort of how I began to take these ultra endurance events like more seriously, because you think of Hong Kong as this huge city, but even if you look at the famous skyline, next time you see the picture, just look a mile back and it's all mountains.
Yeah.
40% of the country is these country parks.
And it's so nice.
So beautiful. And there's this vibrant outdoor ultra running scene. Every weekend from October to March, you can sign up to one of...
And kayaking.
Yeah. And that's how I got into kayaking as well.
Yeah.
But initially it was through ultra running. And then I opened for the national newspaper there, an adventure sports section dedicated to it, because it was such a big sports community there that wasn't being served, because typically in a newspaper you have football, rugby, like other traditional sports, and nobody knew where adventure sports like fitted in. So I started covering that, got into the ultra running scene, interviewing all the people, and every single weekend, and some of the best athletes in the world.
Now you call yourself a sports journalist, an outdoor journalist.
Yeah, so I guess I was doing that in Hong Kong, and then I moved back to the UK in 2021. I still wrote for the newspaper there while I was in the UK and a few others. And then when I went to the Northwest Passage, I've come back, and I'm still occasionally write, but I'm now focusing on being like a keynote speaker and stuff. So
an adventurer.
Yeah, keynote adventure speaker or whatever, yeah.
From rugby into journalist into adventuring, and now you have actually done one of the most amazing adventures still on the planet, I'd say, going into kayak from Baffin Island all the way over to Canada. And that has never been done by a manpower without motors or sails or stuff like that. So this is the first time anyone has done it. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Will also today receive from me the European Adventure of the Year on the big stage down there at the ISPO Fair. And I'm very happy to give it to you, because you're worth it. Together with your American friends, the four of you did this during this summer. So can you just first shortly and briefly, Mark, tell us about the Northwest Passage? What is it?
So the Northwest Passage is the Arctic route that links the Atlantic and the Pacific. If you think about, if you wanted to sail from Europe to Asia and you went around South America, you go around Cape Horn. If you wanted to go over the top of the Americas, you go through the Northwest Passage. And it is northwest of Europe. It's obviously not northwest of Inuit community. So it's a European concept. And the reason we're interested in it is because we wanted to, Britain particularly, wanted to trade with Asia, and they couldn't go via the Spanish colonies. So the first person to try and find it was a man called Martin Frobisher in the 1570s. And that's actually what Canadian Thanksgiving is. It's like in the same way that the Mayflower is the meeting of the Native Americans. It's him meeting the Inuit community. Then the interest continued but waned. Then some other famous explorers tried to find it. Captain Cook tried to find it from the other end. He went through between Alaska and Russia and tried to see if he could get through that way. But what really...
But isn't that called the Northeast Passage?
So the Northeast Passage is over Russia.
Yeah.
So he was trying to go between Russia and in the Bering Strait between Russia and Alaska, then turn right and go over North America.
Turn right.
So they tried to find it from the other end. And they thought, we can't get in over Canada. Let's try and get in over Alaska.
And if you take a look at the globe, one of the main reasons why this was so important or where everybody wanted it, it was this long sailing route going down all the way to the Atlantic, coming to the tip of South Africa or South America.
Well, South Africa and South America is, if you wanted to get to Asia that way, this is like a shortcut.
This is super shortcut.
Yes.
But very dangerous.
But very dangerous. And they weren't even sure if it existed.
But they thought so.
They thought, people were suspicious that the top of the world was an ocean instead of a landmass. They thought, if we can get through that ocean and we can cut off time and we don't have to go via the Dutch or the Spanish, and then we can make our own trade route. And that really took off in the 19th century when Britain was becoming a massive colonial power. And they sent countless expeditions. The most famous is a guy called John Franklin. On his third expedition, he was in a boat called The Erebus and the Terror, which are now so famous. Michael Palin wrote a book called The Erebus, which has just become a bestseller. The BBC just made a 10-part series called The Terror, which is like a fictionalized version of what happened to them. But they got frozen in. They ran out of food. And they ate each other.
Shit.
And then they all died and nobody came back.
Oh, really?
But it became this, like, it caught the British imagination. So for the next 10 years, there were loads of people going up there to try and find out what happened to Franklin. And as a result, they accidentally found the Northwest Passage after 300 or 400 years of looking.
Oh, really?
So in like 1854, a guy called John Ray from Scotland actually found the final piece and proved that it was connected and you could sail the whole thing. But they found it bit by bit, so nobody'd actually got all the way through. So the next challenge, having found it, was who can get all the way through. So Amundsen from Norway.
Amundsen.
Yeah. Am I pronouncing it wrong?
Yeah,
Amundsen. He in 1904 to 1906, took 3 years to get through. He would, sail for a bit and then get frozen in for 11 months and sail for a bit and get frozen in for 11 months. And then the next person to get through was another 50 or 60 years. And then since then, it's just with all that history, with all those famous names, Frobisher, Cook, Franklin, Amundsen. It's just like caught. It's just this place in the adventure community's like imagination of these epic stories. And in the recent years, the ice has began to melt. So Amundsen took years to get through because he'd only have a few weeks at the time of sailing. It's now open for longer and longer. Ironically, it is now plausibly a trade route, which is what people were originally looking for, because you could get a ship the whole way through.
And that's because of the ice. The
ice is retreating, every year. And that also means that it's possible to maybe get through under human power. So in 2007 was the first time it was ice-free. And then people started to think, maybe you could row it, or maybe you could kayak it. So teams started to try and row and kayak. There was also hybrid teams. There was a guy called Tony Lancaster and Kev Oliver. They tried to do it with a sail and oars. And despite the retreating ice, still proved very difficult. And usually people ran out of time before the ice returned or the weather got so bad.
How big of a gap is it to do it?
Well, it depends. Most people said you have 60 or maybe over 60 days just. The ice doesn't return, but the weather does turn bad. So... people said you had 60 days, and we were sort of had about 60 to 90 days worth of food. And when it was taking us longer than we were expecting, and we met sailors, they said, well, you can't go on. You've got till September. We met a whole bunch of adventurers. Somebody who was in a canoe, people who were walking, some people who were sailing, and all of them were getting out. And it was like the 29th of August.
And you were getting in.
And they were saying, we're all leaving for a reason. this is the beginning of September and you're already halfway. And they said, you cannot be here in October. And in a way, they were right, because on like the 30th of September, we went to sleep and we were like, it's very, very cold.
What is very, very cold?
Well, it wasn't that cold. I mean, minus like just under freezing. But like when you're, everything was wet and the wind made it very cold. And particularly the ratio of like days that were paddleable to days where we were stuck in our tent was like very much changing out of our favor. But still, on the 30th...
That means that you had to stay in the tent.
Yeah. So, you know, to begin with, we'd like kayak for 3 days and then be stuck for one. And by the end, we were like stuck for five and kayaking for one. Well, not quite that bad, but like... And we were having to change our risk margin. You know, in the beginning, we'd be like, right, tomorrow the weather forecast is 16 mile an hour winds. We can't kayak. By the end, we were like, great, it's only 16 mile an hour winds. Like, but there was like that... The thing that was strange, they said, you can't be here in October. And on the 30th of September, although it was cold, we were like, it's not that bad. Everybody was exaggerating. It's the 30th October tomorrow and we're fine. Then we woke up on the 1st of October and it was like somebody just turned a switch.
Oh, really?
Everything was white. It was all covered in snow. And it was just still manageable because it's cold. And just because it's cold doesn't mean it's windy. So that the water would be flat on days when it wasn't windy. But they did create a bunch of other unexpected issues, like all the fresh water froze. So one day Eileen and I had to walk. We did like a 4 hour round trip just trying to find some water.
Did you find?
Yeah, and we had to hack through this water with an axe and fill up water. And then, so we filled up our like four bladders, but then the seal on the bladders was frozen, so we couldn't quite tighten the lid. So we had this huge effort to get the water. By the time we walked back, half of it had leaked. And then overnight, it all froze again. So we were like, oh
my gosh.
And it just made life more difficult. Or we'd make these powders for us to have calories on the water. And they'd freeze. So then you can't, we don't have access to as much calories.
But Mark, yeah, just to put us in the situation. So there were four of you.
Yeah. So there's two tandem kayaks. Eileen and I
were tandem, that's like when you paddle two
together,
in a kayak.
Yeah. So Eileen and I were in one kayak and West and Jeff were in another kayak. They're all Americans. West and Jeff are like best friends for 30 years and they've been on other expeditions. First people down the Amazon, Volga River in Russia. And now this one.
So they're really experienced.
Yeah. Very experienced river kayakers. They're all, and Eileen is a super experienced and accomplished ultra kayaker. And they were all much older than me. I'm 32, Eileen's 53, and Jeff and West are in their 60s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, there was like cultural differences, generational differences. Between me being British and them being American, but it was interesting, you know, like having conversations. I love to debate. I like to pass time just by like being devil's advocate and arguing, and it's all good natured as long as nobody takes it personally. And they're very good at that. So West, I had a lot of like conversations about like different perspectives on the world and stuff. But equally, we all. It didn't feel like that. It didn't feel like I was there with people from like a different planet from me. And we all had like much in common and getting great chats. So it was.
But how did you sleep?
All four of us in one tent.
All four in one tent. So that was packed down in one kayak.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there was how big was the tent?
It's a 4-man tent. I don't know how it was. Basically, just big enough for all four of us to lie down, and my head touched the top and my toes touched the bottom.
Yeah, but it was good.
It was very good in wind. In the wind, like no matter how strong the wind was, never felt that windy. It was not good in the wet. And when it started raining, everything got wet. And there was like a three day period where we couldn't kayak, and it was just raining, and we were like using towels to like mop the bottom of the tent.
Oh, really?
Like that. It was, and then nothing ever got dry again, and that was really grim.
But did you kayak in a wetsuit, in a dry suit,
yeah.
All day,
every day, yeah.
But don't you get like hydrated and wet within just sitting in it?
Yeah, so your base layers were really get wet either through sweat or, you know, dry suit is dry, but not like 100% dry. Things maybe like begin to seep in through your neck. and then you'd never get a chance to get dry again. So being wet was just like a constant. And you were just sort of, yeah, I remember thinking to myself, when I finish this, I'll never have to be wet again.
So you were actually wet every day.
Yeah, and Jeff was really good at making fires. Like he could make a fire out of like a wet blanket. He's like a miracle worker. So whenever we did have days that were, we couldn't kayak, but because it was windy, but not because it was wet, like it wasn't always wet, then Jeff would make a fire And we'd spend a long time drying our clothes. And then that felt like an absolute luxury. And then within half a day, they were wet again. So it almost felt arbitrary. But I was working on the policy in the outdoors is always you could always get wetter. So no matter how wet my clothes were, I made like a meticulous effort to like pack them away at night, not get them wetter. Some of the other people were like, well, it's already soaked, so it doesn't matter. They'd leave them outside. Or what's the point trying to like pack them away? They're already soaked. But yeah, and I actually suffered from the cold a little bit less than the others. And I think part of that was because I was like, they can always get wetter. And even if it was a short-term cold, if I was scooping water out, I'd take my gloves off. It would make my hands very cold in the short term, but my gloves weren't wet. You know,
so, I totally agree upon that. Yeah. You have to take care of your gear.
Yeah.
Especially when you're out for a long time.
Wes got frostbite on his hands.
Oh, really?
And in the last day, I lent him my gloves and he gave them back to me 20 minutes later, like soaked. And I was like, these have been dry for 101 days. What did you do? And he sort of sarcastically said, well, I put out the tent. You can do it next time if you want to. And I was like, no wonder you got frostbite. In 20 minutes, your gloves are soaked. You know, I've been putting my hand into ice cold water to scoop it out without my gloves on. So,
How was the dynamics within the group after a couple of days? You know, you were out for 103 days, huh?
Yeah.
And I mean, you were living pretty tight.
Well, I mean, part of expeditioning with a team is that you're not always going to be best friend from like minute one to minute 50. Tensions are going to build over different things. You're not even going to realize what's annoying other people until they snap and vice versa. And that's just part of it. But equally, I would never do something like this by myself because a huge core motivation for me is the camaraderie, the shared experience. The experience of being in nature is amazing. And for me, it's made much more amazing because I get to share it with people. So for sure, there were tensions here and there. I got along with everybody, and sharing it with them is amazing and a privilege. And I never would have done it if it wasn't for them inviting me along.
But the two guys that were in one kayak, they did not have anything actually. Like they had their own lives. The girl that you were kayaking with, she didn't hang along with one of the guys, or no.
What do you mean?
Not married or?
Oh no, so. West and Jeff are both married to people who they live in Texas.
Yeah.
And Eileen is not married, but she has a, you know, her rich life. She's a marine biologist. I've got three adult kids.
Oh.
And then I've got a wife and a one-year-old kid. So, you know, we're all at sort of different stages of our lives. But yeah, I guess sort of what one aspect of it is that West and Jeff were best friends for 30 years and they were in a different kayak. So inevitably you end up speaking with the person in your own kayak more.
How was the days? Tell me about it. A normal day. What happened? What time did you get up?
Well, it changed very much from the first and the second half. The first half was 24-hour daylight. So we weren't necessarily restricted to a typical day. We'd go on the weather windows or wherever we were ready. In the second half, when you have a night, which like starts at 8 and finishes at 5, then you have to be more regimented. And on the second half, we try and do 10 hours every day from 7 a.m. till 5 p.m., which meant getting up at 4 and being in bed by like 8 or 9 p.m.
And you pitched your tent every day?
Yeah.
On the ice?
No, on the land. On the ice. Even one time when we had to get out on ice, we were like, we still can't camp on the ice because we're not sure if our like kit is good enough. Like we're seeing what the Inuit were sleeping on when they slept on ice with huge, thick like mats. We thought maybe we'll go to sleep and not wake up. So I strapped the kayak around my waist with the others and we towed it for like 5 hours just to get back to land and then sleep. And woke up in the morning and towed it back and more ice had come in. So we towed for 9 hours to get back to water. That was day one. But after that, we were on land every time.
Really? So yeah. I thought there was ice all over.
So we started in ice, but then there was no ice. So we never camp on ice. Never.
Oh,
camp.
Yeah.
But I mean, ice that moves can move very far, very quickly. So God knows where we end up. And also it wouldn't count if we rode ice for 50 miles. But, I guess the typical day, and this, I guess, this links what's a typical day and one of the tensions. An ongoing tension was we took a long time to get ready in the morning, a very, very, very long time.
Did you get frustrated by that?
So in the beginning, Eileen and I were very frustrated by it. If I said somebody took a frustratingly long time to get ready from camping, what time would you guess?
Oh, I would say if take a long time, just taking down your tent, putting all the gear together, getting ready. Or do you include breakfast?
And breakfast, yeah. From alarm to getting...
I'll say 1 hour.
So 3.5.
Oh, really? That's a long time.
Yeah, and on the first couple of days, it took like 6.
Oh,
so
really?
So Eileen and I started, Eileen in particular, take down the tent, pack up, do the mats, make breakfast. Jeff started making breakfast in the last couple of weeks, but trying to do everything so Jeff and West had...
Why did it take so long time?
Well, we don't know, and it was very frustrating.
But you were there.
I know. I was watching, and I was like, I actually don't know what's going on anymore. But then equally, West and Jeff were much faster at kayaking. Particularly me, I was the least experienced kayaker, so whichever boat I was in was inevitably going to be the slowest.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I guess one tension was they were thinking, we could cover this distance quicker. And we were thinking, well, we could kayak for longer because we would take an hour to get ready, not 3.5.
How far apart were you when you were kayaking?
Never that far apart in the first half. And then just after halfway, there was a period where Jeff and Wes started going on far ahead of us. And then they'd camp and we'd catch up. And that's where the tension built about, you know, they were saying, this is the speed we have to go. And we were saying, well, why don't we leave earlier? Because we can get ready quicker. So that was like the manifestation of that tension.
Did it get worse?
And then after that, we spoke about it and it was good to get it out there. And sometimes we'd say, look, the weather's good. We know where we're landing. We can see it. Why don't you guys go ahead? But we never left without them. But so that was like one of the tensions. And I guess the ultimate answer is we both could have done it quicker because they would have got ready in 3.5 hours and kayaked quicker. And we would have got ready in 1 hour and kayaked longer. I guess the big hamstring of not being able to get ready quickly was we didn't have any chance to be dynamic. If there was like, right, there's weather coming in tomorrow at midday. Okay, why don't we kayak till 11? You can't do that if it takes 3.5 hours to get ready.
No.
Or the ice has moved. Let's take this like this face. And then there's no point in only going 10 miles if it takes 3.5 hours to get ready and then 3.5 hours at the other end. So, but then equally, it would have been very frustrating for them to get ready and then have to go slower because of me. So I'm not saying, oh, I would have done it quicker. I'm saying that, like, these are the realities.
but how much did you do the navigation? How much difficult was it to navigate?
So I, from about a third of the way through, I'd say I did a lot of the navigation with the Garmin, with the GPS. You'd set a waypoint and you'd go in a straight line. I am quite good at that, I think. So I think I saved a lot of time for the group by doing that. I found that very, very mentally taxing. Because I'm
what does that mean?
Like, so I'm looking, especially on a long crossing.
Mentally taxing.
Yeah, like mentally draining.
Ah.
On the long crossings or in fog, I've got to be constantly looking at it and saying to Eileen, a little bit left, a little bit right, a little bit left.
Were you in the front or the back?
Front.
In the front.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm trying to be immersed in nature. I'm trying to have conversations and build camaraderie. These are my core goals. And I'm having to look at a screen. And it was fine for one day, but when I did it for a few days in a row, it actually like almost reduced me to tears on one like crossing. I was like, people were like, is it that beach or that beach? I'm like, I don't care anymore. Just please land. I just don't want to look at the screen. I just want to enjoy myself. And then in the final 2 weeks, I think I almost, no, maybe the less than that final few days, I'd like almost lost my touch, you know, that I'd actually be aiming for the wrong thing and stuff because I'd spent so much energy on it. And I was conscious that there was only a few days left. So I was like, I'm going to try and look up and enjoy nature and stay present.
Well, you can't if you're navigating.
And so then like there would be like little constant adjustments. Actually, it's a little bit to the right, it's a little bit to the left. And I think that probably frustrated the teammates.
Because they got used to you being on the map.
Yeah, and they'd be like, hey, maybe you could like, you know, are you sure it's that far right? Or maybe you could change the orientation of your map if you're finding it difficult. And I was like, I was good at this for like 2 months and I just wish that it was.
How did you put the energy into your devices?
So we had a little windmill from a company called Tex Energy.
Oh, really?
And they were great at charging our garments.
So you put up small.
A little windmill and
that
was fantastic. It was way even better than I thought it would be. And then I had a big battery pack as well from a company called Volterik. That was amazing. And that
and what kind of gear did you have for your energy? You had the map?
So we Garmin, some cameras, Kindles for the days we were stuck on shore. And then in the second half, when we like stripped down a lot, we basically only had Garmins, a mini Garmin for texting. Whereas in the first half, we had a sat phone and just one Garmin. And one
why did this gear down?
Well, we, I can't really remember what the official decision was, but
just
go, go faster, less power, a whole bunch of things, I suppose. Yeah.
And was it worth it?
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah. Particularly on the power. I was paranoid about power in the first half because I felt like, you know, power is being used for a lot of stuff, like cameras and stuff. And I was constantly worried that what if we run out of power and then we can't use the Garmins? And the Garmins are everything.
Yeah.
And in the second half, we never even really needed the windmill. We had the battery packs did it all. We put the windmill up a couple of times, but we didn't need it.
Yeah. There's always wind there, isn't it?
Well, when we were on shore, we were like stuck on shore in a storm. We were there by definition because it was too windy. But on the days where we kayaked, it was sometimes beautifully flat, particularly when we came out of Cambridge Bay at halfway. And this was when everybody said, it's already September, it's too late. You know, we leave with a lot of anxiety. And as we left, it was like snowing sideways. And we thought, oh my God, everybody's right. And then we had these five beautiful days, like sun, sunburn, flat. And on those days, we did like 40 miles, 40 miles, 30 miles, 35 miles, 39 miles. And then we had a 6-day storm. So yeah, I mean, there was days that were beautiful, days that were like not.
So it's been quite a journey, huh?
Yeah.
And you're really happy that you're done?
Yes.
And how do you feel now? When I've been doing my adventures, there's always this sort of frustration coming when you're done and you start, even before you're done, I usually start thinking about what I should do next. But it always takes longer to get from this thought, leaving the adventure that you're on and trying to get the energy to get out on a new one. But that's me. So this is a major thing for you, I think.
Yeah.
Because this has been a major...
years of my life.
Adventure.
I first thought of it in 2016.
I remember.
I called somebody because initially I wanted to row it. I heard if somebody else wanted to row it. And I called him just before I tried to row the Atlantic. And I said, I'm about to row the Atlantic. When I'm back, let's talk about rowing the Northwest Passage. 2016 to now is almost a quarter of my life.
Yeah.
Okay, and...
That's a long time.
It's a long time. And then 2019, 2020 was when I really started, you know, raising money, putting it out there, writing about it. And I guess, and a lot of people warned me about what you're talking about there, post-expedition blues, where life was so simple out there and suddenly you're having to deal with
it. That's everything. A nice word, post-expedition blues.
Yeah, but I haven't had it. I haven't had the post-expedition blues. I feel very, very, very content.
Motivated.
Content.
Like, are you happy?
Yeah, just, well, there's two things which
you're not going to do it again.
I'm not going to do it again. There's two things I feel which I didn't realize before could be different. There's pride in the achievement, but then there's contentment in the experience. You know, like, and you can be proud of the experience, but think, oh, I'm so proud that we did it, but the team dynamics, or, you know, I wish I'd done this differently, or it wasn't as fun as I thought it was going to be, or I still wish I was out there, but I'm content. Like, I'm proud we did it, and I'm proud it's over, and I'm content that the way that I got everything I was looking
for. Got the t-shirt. I'm not doing it again.
Well, it's more like I got everything I was looking for. And I didn't realize how much emotion I was carrying. The journey to the start line was so, so difficult for me. Like, failing to row the Atlantic twice as I did absolutely devastated me. And like, I spent like over a year, just completely in a spiral, like, who am I? And then I tried to organize a rowing team to do the Northwest Passage, and it didn't go well. Oh God, I'm emotional thinking about it now. And then when we finished, like, the last minute was one of the most intense minutes of the entire passage. There was these breaking waves going down onto the Cape Bathurst spit, and we had to surf down the waves. And up until then, everything it had required was grunt, pushing yourself, mental strength. It hadn't required necessarily much skill, but this was like skill. You have to surf, and you have to surf precisely, because if you capsize, you're in a lot of trouble. And I'd learned how to surf only just before I started the Northwest Passage. And so it was like at the absolute edge of my skill level. And Eileen and I were having like a bit of, we're best friends. Like I owe her everything. And in those last 2 minutes, we were getting frustrated at each other. You know, go left, try and avoid this one. And then we started to surf and everything aligned. You know, suddenly we're on the same page and we're surfing perfectly. And I'm communicating with her, wave coming, okay, now, push, surf. And we shot out past the Cape into completely flat water. And I tried to say, we've done it. And I just started crying and shaking with tears, thinking about everything that it cost me emotionally and financially, time. And I was just thinking about my wife, and I cried and I cried and I cried. And it was the biggest emotional release of my life. And I didn't expect that. I thought about Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, and as soon as he hit the winning shot and he saw that it was the winning shot, he let go of his racket and dropped to his knees. Yeah. And I thought, I now know what he feels like. I guess the pride and contentment I'll come back to. The pride is in the achievement, but my problem, the reason I felt so bad after failing the Atlantic, is because I'd become too focused on the achievement. And the thing about the achievement is it's binary. You either win or you lose. You set a world record or you don't. And the thing about the contentment is you have to focus on the experience. So I moved away from, I have now, and I will forever move away from focusing entirely on the outcome, completing the Northwest Passage, getting a record, whatever, but focusing on intrinsic values. It's about having an amazing experience in nature, and it's about sharing that amazing experience. So if I hadn't finished the Northwest Passage, would it have been a failure? No, I had an experience in nature, and I shared it with people I care about, will be friends for entire life. And that is what adventure is about.
Thank you very much, Mark. And what a great talk. And you are a true hero and a strong personality and adventurer. I'm so happy that you've been here.
The hero is my wife for looking after my one-year-old and being pregnant at home.
So, Mark, big thank you.
Thank you.
And congratulations once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Det var allt för den här gången, hörrni. Och jag tänkte avsluta lite kort med att återigen tacka mina fantastiska partners och sponsorer som är Bageriprodukter, Acid Training och Adventure Academy. Och återigen, har du en krona över eller är helt enkelt sugen på att bjuda på en kaffekopp, så gå in på min Patreon och köp en kaffe, en kaffelatte eller en hel brunch, så kan jag fortsätta spela in podden, producera nya härliga avsnitt och fortsätta att underhålla dig. Hoppas du har haft en fin lyssning och att vi snart hörs igen. Tack så mycket. Hej då!